As you say, an easier material is one of them. Need payoff question. Would you explain how having an easier material would help you? Buyer. Well, it would certainly cut some of the rejects we're getting during the exposure stage. Seller. Need payoff question. And that would be worth doing? Buyer. Probably. I don't know precisely how much is lost there. It might be enough to make some difference. Seller. Need payoff question. Is there any other way that an easier material could help? Buyer. Those neat cassettes of yours don't need an experienced technician to set them up. Maybe that would help. Yes, if we had a material that was so easy to handle that an assistant could set it up, then the technician could spend more time on the processing stage, which could make a big impact on some of the processor problems we're getting. Hey, I like it. In this example, the seller's use of need payoff questions has allowed the buyer to explain the payoff and, as a result, to find the solution more acceptable. Need payoff questions rehearse the customer for internal selling. In smaller sales, your success rests on how effectively you can convince the person you sell to, but this is not always the case in larger sales. As the size of the decision grows, more people become involved. Your success may often depend not just on how you sell, but on how well the people in the account sell to each other. In the small sale, you're usually there during the whole sales process. But in larger sales, there are likely to be many sales calls where influencers and users sell internally on your behalf and where there's no opportunity for you to be present. A very experienced and successful sales manager in the process control industry was once asked to explain at a company conference how he had succeeded in selling a multi-million-dollar system to a major oil company. He said, "The most important thing to remember about really big sales is that you only play a small part in the selling. The real selling goes on in the account when you're not there, when the people you sold to go back and try to convince the others. I'm certain that the reason I succeeded was because I spent a lot of time trying to make sure that the people I talked to knew how to sell for me. I was like the director of a play. My work was during rehearsals. I wasn't on stage during the performance. Too many people in selling want to be great actors. My advice is that if you want to make really big sales, you've got to realize that even if you're a great performer, you won't be on stage for more than a fraction of the selling time. Unless you rehearse the rest of the cast, the show will be a flop." Most people with experience in major account selling would agree with this analysis. It's obvious that a lot of selling goes on when you're not around. So the better you prepare your internal sponsors, the easier it will be for them to convince others in the account. The problem is how. What's the best way to rehearse customers so that they sell effectively for you? Here's an extract from a typical call on a buyer who, if convinced, will afterward be selling internally. Seller. "And another way the system will help you is in reduction of inventory levels." Buyer. "Good. That's something we need to do. I'll be talking to the VP of finance tomorrow, and I'll mention this to him." Seller. "Be sure you tell him that we have automatic audit tagging." Buyer. "Audit what?" Seller. "It's a powerful new way to document and retrieve inventory records." Buyer. Okay, I'll mention it." Seller. "Tell him that we cut inventory costs in Snitch Limited by 12%. Buyer. "Because of this automatic audit thing?" Seller. "Yes. And by controlling your seasonal peaks, we could do even better here. You'll let him know this, won't you?" Buyer. Tomorrow may be a bad day for him. The meeting's about a downtown property issue. I'll see what I can do." Even if the buyer does talk with the VP of finance, how effective a piece of selling will it be? It will probably fail because the buyer clearly doesn't understand the product well enough to explain it. Such insufficient understanding is not unusual. It's hard enough for salespeople to acquire all the technical and applications knowledge required to sell a sophisticated product or service. You can't expect the customer to understand in an hour something that's taken you months to learn yourself. But if the customer isn't going to understand your product well enough to sell it effectively, what should you do? In an ideal world, of course, you would persuade the customer to take you along to every meeting. But in real life, this just isn't practical. For one thing, the customer may be reluctant to lose control of the situation by giving you direct contact with top people. For another, it would be physically impossible for you to be present in every sales conversation that goes on inside an account. In a complex purchase, there may be dozens of conversations where your product is discussed between different people in the account. Even if the customer would let you, you couldn't possibly find time to attend every one of these discussions. So there's no escaping the fact that in larger sales, a major part of the selling, perhaps most of it, will be done by your internal supporters while you're not there. This brings us back to the question of how you best prepare a customer to sell on your behalf, which is another area where need payoff questions have a special use. In the next example, the seller uses need payoff questions in a way that will help the buyer sell internally after the call is over. Seller, and another way this system will help you is in reduction of inventory levels. Buyer, good, that's something we need to do. I'll be talking to the VP of finance tomorrow and I'll mention this to him. Seller, need payoff question. You say it's something you need to do. What benefits would you get from lower inventory levels? Buyer, obviously the main one is cost. Seller, need payoff question. Would cost be the most important benefit to your finance VP? Buyer, yes, well, not necessarily. Now that I think about it, there could be another one that's more urgent. At tomorrow's meeting, we're reviewing our downtown warehousing. We're using an expensive site, and our VP would like to close it and consolidate the inventory here. But we don't quite have enough warehousing space at this location. If your system could reduce levels at this site by just 5%, then we could close the downtown building. Seller, need payoff question. And this would save you money? Buyer, about $250,000 a year. If you've got a way to help us do this, I'll try to get 15 minutes with our VP before the meeting. Notice that in this example, the seller uses need payoff questions to get the buyer to describe benefits. In doing so, the seller achieves several things. The buyer's attention is now focused on how the solution would help, not on product details as in the earlier example. I've said that buyers can't be expected to learn about your product in enough depth to explain it convincingly to others. But buyers can be expected to have an understanding of their own problems and needs. Need payoff questions concentrate on the area the buyers understand best, their own business, and how it would be helped by the solution you're proposing. When buyers talk to others in the account, it's in the area of needs, not of products, that they will be most convincing and will contribute most to your sales effort. The buyer is explaining the benefits to the seller, not vice versa. If you can get buyers to explain to you the value of your solution, it's good practice for when they come to give the same explanation to other people in the account. It's a much better rehearsal to get the buyer actively describing benefits to you than it would be for the buyer to listen passively while you describe the same benefits. When buyers feel that their ideas are part of the solution, they gain increased confidence in your product and feel an enthusiasm for it. The very qualities needed to sell the product for you when you're not present during the discussions. In summary, need payoff questions are important because they focus attention on solutions, not problems, and they make customers tell you the benefits. Need payoff questions are particularly powerful selling tools in a larger sale because they also increase the acceptability of your solution. Equally important, success in large sales depends on internal selling by customers on your behalf. And need payoff questions are one of the best ways to rehearse the customer in presenting your solutions convincingly to others. The difference between implication and need payoff questions. Both implication and need payoff questions develop implied needs into explicit needs. And because they have a similar purpose, it's easy to confuse them. Check whether you're clear about the difference between them by deciding which is which in this brief extract from a sales call. 1. Seller. Does the slowness of your present system create bottlenecks in other areas of the process? Buyer. Yes, mostly in the preparation stage. 2. Seller. And the preparation stage is an area you'd like to speed up? Buyer. Yes, we're taking too much time right now in preparation. 3. Seller. Because preparation is so labor-intensive, the excessive time presumably means greatly increased costs? Buyer. Unfortunately, that's true. 4. Seller. And what impact does this have on your competitiveness in a low-margin business like this one? Buyer. It doesn't help. 5. Seller. So what you'd like to see would be a reduction in preparation costs? Buyer. That would certainly make us more competitive. 6. Seller. Is there any other way it would help you? The implication questions are examples 1, 3, and 4. Examples 2, 5, and 6 are need payoff questions. Don't be too dismayed if you found it difficult to decide which was which. At first, even the Hawthwaite team found it hard. In the early stages of our research, we would often come across examples of questions where we weren't sure which category fitted best. We'd write these examples up on a large whiteboard in the office. From time to time, we'd meet to discuss these tough categorization problems. Boundary issues is the technical term, to make sure we had the closely standardized agreement between us that's needed for this kind of research. During one of these discussions, the 8-year-old son of a team member came into the office to collect his father from work. We were in the middle of a lengthy argument about the examples on the board, trying to agree which were implication and which were need payoff questions. The kid looked at the board for a moment and said, that one, and that one are implication questions, and all the others are need payoff questions. We were taken aback. We'd come to the same conclusion, but we needed half an hour to do it. How can you tell? We asked. Easy, he said. Implication questions are always sad. Need payoff questions are always happy. He's right. And since then, we've called it Quincy's Rule, after its 8-year-old discoverer. Put in a more adult way, implication questions are problem-centered. They make the problem more serious, and that's why they are sad. Need payoff questions, in contrast, are solution-centered. They ask about the usefulness or value of solving a problem, and that's why they seem happy. The senior management of our major clients might get the wrong impression if they knew that we'd been teaching their sales force first to ask the sad questions and then to ask the happy questions, particularly if they knew an 8-year-old suggested the distinction. Consequently, we've never made Quincy's Rule public. But if you had trouble with the last examples, then try them again using Quincy's Rules. I think you'll agree that the implication questions, examples 1, 3, and 4, are sadder than the others. Back to open and closed questions. Near the end of Chapter 1, in the section Questions and Success, I described in Hawthwaite team's finding that the traditional opened and closed model of questioning isn't related to effectiveness in larger sales. I'm sure that many readers, brought up on the sensible-sounding distinction between open and closed questions, must have found our conclusions hard to believe. I can now tell you a story that illustrates why the open and closed distinction is less useful than it seems. I was carrying out a study of sales management coaching in a large high-technology company. As part of this study, I traveled with salespeople and watched how they put coaching lessons into practice. One day, I was traveling with an enthusiastic but inexperienced seller. During the call, I recorded how often she used the different types of spin questions. My results from our first call together were situation questions, 35, problem questions, 0, implication questions, 0, need payoff questions, 0. As we know, situation questions can become negatively related to success. The more you ask, the less likely it is that the call will succeed. Predictably, as the call progressed, the buyer first became bored, then became impatient, and finally asked us to leave. Afterward, as we rode down in the elevator, the seller asked me for advice. "I was trying to ask more open questions during this call," she explained. "Do you think I succeeded?" I was forced to reply that unless she asked about an area that had an impact on the customer, such as problems and their implications, it probably didn't make any difference whether her questions were open or closed. The sad truth is that a call which goes no further than situation questions is most unlikely to succeed. I imagine that there are tens of thousands of salespeople like her, struggling valiantly to understand unproductive distinctions between open and closed questions. If only she and all those others understood that the power of a question lies in whether it's asking about an area psychologically important to the customer, not whether it's open or closed. The spin model. Asking questions that are important to the customer is what makes the spin model so powerful. Its questioning sequence taps directly into the psychology of the buying process. As we've seen, buyers' needs move through a clear progression from implied to explicit. The spin questions provide a roadmap for the seller, guiding the call through the steps of need development until explicit needs have been reached. And the more explicit needs you can obtain from buyers, the more likely the call is to succeed. Let's briefly review the whole spin model and make a few observations about its use. Most importantly, please don't see spin as a rigid formula. It's not. Selling by a fixed formula is a sure recipe for failure in larger sales. Instead, see the model as a broad description of how successful salespeople probe. Treat it as a guideline, not a formula. In summary, our research on questioning skills shows that successful salespeople use the following sequence. 1. Initially, they ask situation questions to establish background facts, but they don't ask too many because situation questions can bore or irritate the buyer. 2. Next, they quickly move to problem questions to explore problems, difficulties, and dissatisfactions. By asking problem questions, they uncover the customer's implied needs. 3. In smaller sales, it could be appropriate to offer solutions at this point, but in successful larger sales, the seller holds back and asks implication questions to make the implied needs larger and more urgent. 4. Then, once the buyer agrees that the problem is serious enough to justify action, successful salespeople ask need payoff questions to encourage the buyer to focus on solutions and to describe the benefits that the solution would bring. In a nutshell, this is the spin model. Of course, it doesn't always work in quite this sequence. For example, if a customer begins a call by giving you an explicit need, you might go straight to need payoff questions to get the buyer talking about how the benefits you could offer would help meet this need. Or sometimes, when you're exploring a problem or its implications, you may have to ask situation questions to give you more background facts. But in most calls, the questioning naturally follows the spin sequence. Many experienced salespeople, when introduced to the four simple questions, say, "I could have told you that without needing $1 million of research. It's just common sense." And of course, they are right. We found this model by watching thousands of successful people sell. So it's not surprising that spin should make immediate and obvious sense to successful people. I don't like to describe the spin model as some revolutionary discovery about how to sell. It's much better to think of it as the way most successful people sell on a good day when the call is going well. Let me invite you to think of one of your most successful calls. Didn't it broadly follow the spin model? Didn't you begin by finding out something about the customer's situation? So presumably you started out with situation questions, but fairly quickly you moved into discussion of a problem the customer had. How did you do this? By asking problem questions. Then, if you think of your most successful calls, you'll recall that as the customer talked, the problem seemed to get bigger and more urgent. Why did this happen? Presumably because you were developing the problem with implication questions. Finally, in your very best calls, were you telling the customer the benefits? Or was the customer getting excited and telling you, saying things like, "Hey, another way you could help me would be..." In most of my successful sales, it's been the customer who is giving benefits. And how did this happen? Because I used need payoff questions, and I'm sure this is exactly what you've done in your successful calls too. So you're probably using the spin model already in your most effective sales. Spin isn't new and unexpected. Its strength comes from putting a simple and precise description to a complex process. Consequently, it helps you see what you're doing well and helps you pinpoint areas where you need more practice. How to use spin questions. To ask spin questions effectively, begin by recognizing that your role in a sales call is that of problem solver. Customer problems or implied needs are at the heart of every sale. Over the years, I've helped my own selling enormously by clearly recognizing this simple fact. Before I go into a call, I ask myself, what problems can I solve for this customer? The clearer I can be about the problems I can solve, the easier it is to ask effective questions during the discussion. Here is a simple technique to help you plan your call strategy and questions. Before the call, write down at least three potential problems which the buyer may have and which your products or services can solve. Then write down some examples of actual problem questions that you could ask to uncover each of the potential problems you've identified. I'm not alone in finding it useful to list problem areas before each call. An experienced seller from a division of Kodak wrote me, "I've been selling for more than 20 years, and when you suggested making a list of problem areas before each visit, I thought the idea was too simple to be worth the effort. But I tried it, and it's proved a very useful way to clarify my thinking and speed me successfully through the early stages of the sale." Many other people have found this simple suggestion helpful. Try it. In this way, you'll uncover implied needs more quickly, and it will also help keep you from spending too much time asking unnecessary situation questions. Most salespeople find implication questions harder to ask than either situation or problem questions. In the average sales call we studied, only one out of every 20 questions asked was an implication question. It seems that, powerful though implication questions are, people have difficulty using them. Yet there's good evidence, see Appendix A if you're a doubter, that if you ask more implication questions, your calls will be more successful. What practical advice can we offer to help you use implication questions more often and more effectively? From our experience, the main reason why people ask so few of these important questions is that they don't plan them in advance. Here's a simple way to help you plan implication questions. How to plan implication questions. 1. Write down a potential problem the customer is likely to have. 2. Then ask yourself what related difficulties this problem might lead to and write these down. Think of these difficulties as the implications of the problem and be especially alert for those implications which reveal the problem to be more severe than it may originally have seemed. As shown, for example, a seller planning a call has identified existing machine is hard to use as a potential problem and has then thought of 4 related difficulties, one of which is that there may be a shortage of qualified people to operate the machine. 3. For each difficulty, write down the questions it suggests. For instance, in the figure, the seller has noted that the shortage of qualified people suggests implication questions about overtime costs and recruitment difficulties. This is a very simple method, but it works well. Even the smartest people we've studied find it hard to ask implication questions unless they've planned them in advance. Whether you use our simple method or a more elaborate one of your own, the basic principle is the same. Good questions won't just spring into your mind while you're talking with a customer. Unless you plan your questions in advance, you won't think of them during the call. Using need payoff questions effectively. Need payoff questions are so simple and so powerful that you'd expect them to be part of every sales call. No other type of question has so consistently positive an effect on the customer. Consequently, it still is a surprise to me that in almost half the calls we studied, the sellers didn't use any need payoff questions at all. It seems that, as with implication questions, people find them hard to ask. Even worse, when the average seller does use a need payoff question, it's often at the wrong point in the call. So let's look first at when not to ask need payoff questions, and then at how to increase our skills in asking them at the right point in the call. Avoid need payoff questions early in the call. Some people make the mistake of using need payoff questions too early in the call, before they've identified the customer's problems. Paul Landauer of Abbott Laboratories tells the story of watching one of his salespeople open a call with a need payoff question. "Mr. Customer, if I could show you something interesting, would you be interested?" In a less bizarre form, calls are often opened with questions like, "If I could show you a way to increase productivity here, would you put my company on your bid list?" Or, "Would you be interested in a faster way to process your accounts?" These are need payoff questions, but asked so early in the call, they are likely to put the customer on the defensive and thus be ineffective. The top performers we studied first built up needs before asking need payoff questions. I'd advise you to do the same. Avoid need payoff questions where you don't have answers. Unfortunately, the only time when less effective salespeople will unfailingly ask need payoff questions is at the worst possible point in the call. Take this example. Customer, explicit need. "I must have a machine that can give me double-sided copies." Seller, whose machine can't copy on both sides. "Why do you need double-sided copies?" Customer, explaining the need. "Because it will reduce my paper cost, and also, if we send double-sided copies through the mail, they're lighter, which cuts postage costs. There's another plus to double-sided copying, too. It means we don't need so much filing space, and that's really important here." The seller has asked a need payoff question. Why do you need double-sided copies? It would be an excellent question if the seller were able to meet the need because it encourages the customer to explain the benefits of double-sided copying. But for this seller, who can only offer single-sided copying, it's the worst possible question to ask. As a result of the need payoff question, the customer's need grows stronger and the seller can't meet it. Most of us fall into this trap from time to time. We ask need payoff questions for the needs we can't meet rather than for the needs we can. I'm sure you've asked the obvious question, why do you want to do that? When one of your customers has requested a capability you don't offer. The customer then responds to your question by telling you why the capability is important and, in so doing, strengthens the need for it. The worst point to ask a need payoff question is when the customer raises a need you can't meet. Conversely, the best point is when you can meet the need. Yet, ironically, this is when most people seem least likely to ask a need payoff question. If the seller in the example above had a machine that offered double-sided copies, do you think she'd have asked the need payoff question? Probably not. In our studies, we found that when customers raised needs that the seller could meet, the most likely response from the seller was not to ask need payoff questions, but to begin talking about solutions. Practicing effective need payoff questions. Implication questions require careful planning. You can't improve your skills with them unless you're prepared to invest a lot of patience and effort. At the same time, we've seen people dramatically increase their skills with need payoff questions just by consolidating the idea with some straightforward practice exercises. Here's an example of a simple exercise that helps you practice need payoff questions. 1. Get a friend or colleague to help you. The person you choose needn't know anything at all about selling. My son has been my victim for this exercise. 2. Choose a topic about a need that you believe the other person has. You might, for example, choose to talk about a new car, a vacation, a change of job, or, as in my son's case, a video camera. 3. Ask need payoff questions to get the other person talking about the benefits of the topic under discussion. In my case, for example, I asked my son questions like these. Why do you think it would be good to have a video camera? What would it let us do that we can't do right now? Would anyone else in the family be pleased if we bought one? Do you think it would have cost advantages compared with Super 8 film? When you try this exercise, notice two things about it. 1. As in real life, it builds up noticeable enthusiasm in your customer. A major account seller from Xerox once told me that he tried out the exercise with a friend using a new car as the topic. A week later, she actually bought a new car, explaining to him, "Your questions really convinced me. I should." The power of need payoff questions is often visible in these simple practice demonstrations. Watch for it. 2. Unlike implication questions, which tend to be specific to a particular customer problem, need payoff questions have wide generality. Many of the questions you'll use in this practice exercise are the same ones you can use in real calls. There are many generic need payoff questions such as these. Why is that important? How would that help? Would it be useful if? Is there any other way this could help you? Practice these first in safe situations like this exercise, then try them in real calls. I think you'll be surprised at their effectiveness. Chapter 5, Giving Benefits in Major Sales. We've seen in Chapter 4 how the spin model provides a strong probing framework for the investigating stage of the call. In this chapter, I want to show you what Huthwaite's research found about the demonstrating capability stage. Figure 5.1 highlights the demonstrating capability stage of the four stages of a sales call: preliminaries, investigating, demonstrating capability, and obtaining commitment, as offering your solutions and capabilities to the customer. Features and benefits, the classic way to demonstrate capability. Sales training and books on selling have given a lot of attention to methods for demonstrating capability. Since the 1920s, it's been recognized that some ways of presenting solutions to customers are more persuasive than others. Anybody who has been through a sales training program in the last 60 years is likely to have been taught the terms features and benefits as the two ways that you can describe your products or services. We're all so familiar with the concept that it scarcely seems necessary to explain that features are facts about a product and are unpersuasive, whereas benefits, which show how features can help the customer, are a much more powerful way to describe your capabilities. If there was one area of selling where we expected our research merely to confirm the conventional wisdom, it was here with features and benefits. But we were in for some surprises. Benefits, in the way you've probably been taught to use them, are ineffective in larger sales and are likely to create a negative response from the customer. And even something as simple as defining a benefit is much harder than it seems. Before looking at our conclusions, let's begin by reviewing some basics. Features. Everybody knows what features are. They are facts, data, or information about your products or services. Typical examples of features include, this system has 512K buffer storage. This is a four-stage exposure control, and our consultants have a background in educational psychology. Features, as every writer has observed since the 1920s, are unpersuasive. Because they give neutral facts, they don't much help your sales presentation. On the other hand, the consensus of writers is that they don't harm you either. What does our research show? Figure 5.2 shows that features are facts or characteristics of a product or service. Research shows that features have a positive effect on small sales and are neutral or unpersuasive in larger sales. Examples are, it costs $15,000. We have two machines in this range, and there's a 5-week delivery. From an analysis of the number of features used in 18,000 sales calls, we found the following. Overall, the level of features is slightly higher in unsuccessful calls, which, you'll remember, are those leading to continuations and no sales. But this difference is small enough for us to conclude that the conventional wisdom is right. Features are neutral. They don't help the call, but they don't harm it much either. In small sales, there's a slight positive relationship between the use of features and call success, so the calls higher in features are slightly more likely to result in orders or advances. This relationship isn't true in larger sales. In larger sales, features have a negative effect when used early in the call and a neutral effect when used later. Users respond more positively to features than do decision makers. In the middle of very complex selling cycles of technical products, the customer sometimes develops a features appetite. When this happens, the customer demands considerable product detail and may respond positively to features. It's at this stage of the selling cycle that technical experts, systems analysts, and other sales support people often have a positive impact on a customer. We also found some curious relationships between the use of features and the type of response from customers, which we'll explore more in the next chapter. But generally, our work on features confirmed what writers have been saying for 50 years. Features are low-power statements that do little to help your sell. It's better to use benefits than features. What's a benefit? Our problem started when we began to investigate benefits. While everybody agrees on the definition of a feature, no two writers on selling seem to have the same definition of a benefit. Here are some of the many definitions that we uncovered from a miserable month spent reading every sales book and training program we could find. A benefit shows how a feature can help a customer. A benefit must have a cost saving for the buyer. A benefit is any statement that meets a need. A benefit has to appeal to the personal ego needs of the buyer, not to organizational or departmental needs. A benefit must be something which you can offer and which your competitors can't. A benefit gives a buying motive. There are more. Some definitions emphasize financial elements, and some concentrate on personal appeal. Others accept any elaboration of a feature, such as explaining how it can be used. My personal favorite was from a sales manager in Honeywell, who told me, "A benefit is anything you say to a customer that's smarter than a feature." Which definition is right? How can we tell which of these definitions is better than the others? There's only one valid test. The best of these rival definitions is the one that has the most positive impact on customers. Is there one of these types of benefits that occurs more often than others in successful calls? Our research team set out to test this by watching sales calls and counting how often the different types of benefits were used in calls that succeeded and in calls that failed. After this initial testing of a half dozen different definitions, we chose two for our major research test. Type A benefit. This type shows how a product or service can be used or can help the customer. Type B benefit. This type shows how a product or service meets an explicit need expressed by the customer. We chose the type A definition because it was the most common one used in the Better Sales Training programs. Most readers of this book will have been taught to use the type A benefit. In contrast, the type B benefit was our own definition. We chose it after watching hundreds of very effective salespeople in larger sales and analyzing the types of product statements they made to their customers. At first sight, these two definitions of a benefit seem very similar. However, their effect on customers is dramatically different, so it's worth examining how the two differ. For example, suppose I'm selling you a computer system and I say, I assume you want a 32-bit system like our Suprox machine. Because, if you ever use graphics, it will be significantly faster for you. Have I made a type A or a type B statement? It can't be type B, for I've assumed that you want faster graphics. You haven't actually expressed a need for graphics, let alone faster ones. Take another example. You tell me that your present machine has a reliability problem. I reply, because our Suprox machine uses a new generation of high reliability components, it could solve your present reliability problem. What kind of statement is this? This time you've certainly expressed a need. You've told me that your present machine is unreliable. But have you expressed an explicit need? No. Telling me that your present machine has a reliability problem is an implied need, a problem, difficulty, or dissatisfaction. So my statement meets an implied need, not an explicit need. Once again, we should classify it as a type A benefit, not a type B. How important is the difference? In our research test, we found that the type A benefit is quite strongly related to success in smaller sales, but is only slightly related to success in larger sales. We'll see why later in this chapter. In contrast, the type B benefit is very strongly related to success in all sizes of sales. I don't know about you, but personally I find it hard to remember which is which whenever anything is labeled A or B. I wasn't the only one who found it confusing to refer to type A and type B benefits, so we soon decided that it would be better to avoid further difficulties by putting more descriptive names in place of A and B. We called the type A benefit an advantage, and for the type B benefit, because it was so strongly related to success, we kept the name benefit. Thus, what emerged from our research are three kinds of statements or behaviors that you can use to demonstrate capability, as shown in Figure 5.3, which lists features, advantages, and benefits. Features describe facts, data, and product characteristics. They have a slightly positive impact on small sales and a neutral or slightly negative impact on larger sales. Advantages, for type A benefits, show how products, services, or their features can be used or can help the customer. They have a positive impact on small sales and a slightly positive impact on larger sales. Benefits, or type B benefits, show how products or services meet explicit needs expressed by the customer. They have a very positive impact on both small and larger sales. It's important to remember that if you've been through sales training in the last 20 years, you've probably been taught to use a lot of type A benefits or advantages. But as you can see in figures 5.3 and 5.4, advantages are more powerful in simpler sales than they are in the larger sales that are the subject of this book. Figure 5.4 shows that advantages for type A benefits show how a product or service can be used or can help the customer. Research shows that advantages have a positive effect on small sales but little effect on larger sales, and have less impact late in the selling cycle. Examples are, which means it's cheaper to operate, the automatic feed will save you time, and it's quieter than the competition's machine. Almost certainly, you'll experience some confusion between the definition of benefit that we're using here and the definitions you've learned in the past. Most salespeople I've worked with hate quibbling about definitions, and I don't blame them. But in this case, definitions are vitally important. For example, the Motorola Canada Productivity Study described in Appendix A shows that salespeople who use benefits rather than advantages increase their dollar volume of sales by 27%. That's more than a quibble. When the definition is derived from choosing the statements that have the highest impact on customers, then we're not just playing with words. Because the differences between features, advantages, and benefits are so important, I'd like to give you a chance to test your understanding of them by working through the following short transcript. See if you can pick out which of the 10 product statements offer features, advantages, or benefits. Then check your answers against the ones given at the end of this chapter. Types of product statements. 1. Seller. And another thing about the system is that it has balanced voltage stabilization. Buyer. Oh, what does that do? 2. Seller. It protects you from current surges so that you won't lose valuable data if you have a voltage fluctuation. Buyer. That isn't necessary here. This building is wired for scientific use, so there's inbuilt voltage protection. 3. Seller. But I'm sure you'll find the backup memory useful. It means that even in the event of an operator error wiping out your main files, you'll always have automatic backup, so you'll never run the risk of losing key data. Buyer. And how much does this configuration cost? 4. Seller. The basic core system costs $78,000. Buyer. And is it compatible with our optical readers? I need to be able to read source data straight into memory. 5. Seller. Yes, you'll be able to read your present data without any conversion. So if you want to read directly into memory, you'll be able to do that. Buyer. That's good. How about error rates? I must have less than 1 in 100,000. 6. Seller. Then you'll be glad to hear that the system has one of the lowest error rates on the market, less than 1 in 1,500,000, which easily meets your need. Buyer. Fine. 7. Seller. And because of the low error rate, you can also use the system to rerun and verify data from your other processing sources, thus saving you the cost of a separate verification process. Buyer. I'm not sure about that. We have other security issues around data verification, which means we wouldn't be permitted to take data from our other sources. 8. Seller. On the subject of security, the system has 8 levels of possible coding built in. Buyer. Are they user-determined? 9. Seller. On 5 levels, the other 3 are randomized or time-based. Buyer. Time-based? 10. Seller. Oh yes, you see, the big plus of a time-based system for an organization like yours is that you can simultaneously and automatically roll over access codes between operating units, which means that your operators don't have to memorize new codes. Yet it's almost impossible for outsiders to break in. Now that you're familiar with the rather special way we use the terms advantages and benefits, let's examine the research evidence in more detail. The relative impacts of features, advantages, and benefits. I've said that advantages, statements showing how your product can be used or can help the customer, have a much more positive impact on small sales than on larger ones. Why? It seems odd that the impact should be so much less in a large sale. The most probable answer goes back to the points I made about simple sales in Chapter 4. Remember that we showed you how to be very successful in smaller sales by using situation and problem questions to uncover implied needs and then offering solutions. What would these solutions be in terms of features, advantages, and benefits? They can't be benefits because, as we've seen, you can only make a benefit if you address an explicit need that the customer has expressed. In this case, the solutions are offered to implied needs, so they must be either features or advantages. We've seen that offering solutions to implied needs isn't effective in larger sales, so this use of features and advantages, which can work perfectly well in a small sale, is likely to be ineffective as the sale grows larger. Figure 5.5 shows a recipe for success in the smaller sale, but disaster for the larger sale. It shows situation questions to establish background information, leading to problem questions about difficulties or dissatisfaction, to uncover implied needs, problems your product could solve, solved by offering solutions and capabilities, showing how you can meet the implied needs. This explains why our research found that benefits are so much more powerful in large sales. To make a benefit, you must have an explicit need. Figure 5.6 states that benefits, type B benefits, show how a product or service meets an explicit need expressed by the customer. Research shows that benefits have a strongly positive effect on sales of all sizes and are the most powerful statements you can make in larger sales. Examples are, you need immediate delivery. We can offer it from stock. This will give you the faster speed you want. And This energy-saving circuit gives the economy you're looking for. But in order to get the explicit need, you normally must first develop it from an implied need by using implication and need payoff questions. Using benefits, as we define them, can't be divorced from the way you develop needs. When my colleagues and I at Huthwaite run training programs, we are often asked for advice on how to use more benefits. Our reply is simple. Do a good job of developing explicit needs, and the benefits almost look after themselves. If you can get your customers to say, "I want it," it's not difficult to make a benefit by replying, "We can give it to you." Benefits and call success. One of our early studies that confirmed the power of benefits was carried out in a number of high-technology companies across Europe and North America. We compared the level of benefits in 5,000 calls with the outcome of each call. Figure 5.7 shows relationships of benefits to outcome in 5,000 high-technology calls. Chart shows relationship of benefits to sales. Calls were divided into orders, calls obtaining a signed order, 9.2% of seller behavior in the form of benefits. Advances, calls producing actions which progressed the sale to a stage nearer to a decision, 6.3% of seller behavior in the form of benefits. Continuations, calls leading to a further appointment but containing no firm commitment to action, 3.8% of seller behavior in the form of benefits. No sales, calls failing to result in action or further appointment, 2.6% of seller behavior in the form of benefits. We found that benefits, and remember that our definition of a benefit is a statement that shows how you can meet an expressed explicit need, were significantly higher in calls leading to orders and advances. In contrast, the level of advantages, showing how your product can help or be used, what many of us have been taught to call benefits, was not significantly different in successful and unsuccessful calls. Features, advantages, and benefits in the longer selling cycle. One of the curious findings from our research was that the impacts of features, advantages, and benefits on the customer are not similar throughout the selling cycle. We were working with one of the world's leading business machines companies, and part of our investigation involved measuring the effects of sales behaviors at different points in the selling cycle. The average selling cycle in this organization was 7.8 calls long. Company researchers, working with Huthwaite, accompanied salespeople into calls at different points in the cycle. They observed the frequency with which each seller used features, advantages, and benefits, and then compared this data with the outcome of each call. To be technical for a moment, the vertical axis on the graph in figure 5.8 actually shows the significance level of each behavior measured by a battery of non-parametric tests. In simpler terms, the higher a behavior comes on the vertical axis, the more it's likely to help you sell. As you can see in figure 5.8, features had a low impact on the customer throughout the selling cycle. Benefits, on the other extreme, had a high impact whenever they were used. Advantages had an unusual behavior. We found that early in the cycle, particularly during the first call, advantages had a moderately good statistical relationship to call success. This is another way of saying that advantages had a positive impact on the customer during the first call. Sellers who used a lot of advantages were likely to get an advance rather than a continuation or no sale. However, as the cycle progressed, advantages had a decreasing effect on the customer until, as the end of the cycle approached, they were no more powerful than features. Why do advantages run out of steam? To be honest, I'm not sure why advantages are more effective early in the cycle than late. It's one of those findings which the Huthwaite research team still argues about whenever we get together. Possibly it's because, at a first meeting, the customer expects to hear about the product rather than to discuss needs. I'm sure you've often made first visits to customers who start off the call by saying, "Now tell me about this product of yours." I've certainly had customers who don't want to discuss needs until they know more about what I've got to offer. Another possibility is that many of the sellers who jump in early with advantages do so because they are genuinely enthusiastic about their products. They can't wait to start talking solutions. In the short term, their enthusiasm carries them along. at least to the point where the customer agrees to proceed to a further step in the selling cycle. However, if they continue a product-centered approach as the cycle progresses, they aren't responsive to customer needs and therefore become less effective. A third possibility is that advantages, as we've seen earlier, are very quickly forgotten after the call. Consequently, their effect is temporary. In contrast, benefits continue to have an impact between calls because their link to explicit needs helps customers remember them. Whatever the reason, I'm sure you've seen cases in your own company of this phenomenon in action. A typical example is the pushy, aggressive individual who's much more interested in selling the product than in meeting the customer's needs. This kind of person will frequently be very successful in the early stages of the sale. I'm sure you've just listened, as I have, to the stories these people tell about how they've just had a first meeting with a new customer and impressed this customer mightily by the way they put the product across and showed how it could solve all the customer's problems. But how many of these promising beginnings turn into orders? Fewer than you'd expect. And a very likely reason is that the seller's high advantage style has helped early in the cycle but run out of steam as the sale progressed. But whatever the explanations, the research is giving us a simple but important message. Advantages are less powerful than benefits all through the selling cycle. It never pays to offer an advantage if you can go that bit further and offer a benefit. Selling new products. There's one area of demonstrating capability that is generally handled badly, even by experienced salespeople. It happens to be an area vital to most organizations' success, and it's a source of perennial frustration and disappointment to senior management. The area I'm talking about is the new product launch. Over and over again, my Huthwaite colleagues and I are asked by top management to help explain why a new product has failed to meet its initial sales target. What's wrong? They ask. We were sure our projections were realistic, yet now, 6 months into the launch, we're less than 50% of plan. Is it the product? Is it the sales force? What's going wrong? From the many product launches we've studied, one constant fact emerges. The biggest single cause of poor results early in a product's life can be explained in terms of features, advantages, and benefits. The bells and whistle approach. When a product is new, how does product marketing generally communicate it to the sales force? The marketing people call the sellers together and tell them about what an exciting new product is coming. They explain all the features and advantages, all the bells and whistles. And what do the salespeople then do? They become excited about the product and go out to sell it. And when they are in front of customers, how do they behave? They communicate the product in exactly the same way it was communicated to them. Instead of asking questions to develop needs, they jump in with all the exciting features and advantages that the new product possesses. Figure 5.9 shows the composite data from a number of product launches. As you can see, the average number of features and advantages given when selling new products is more than 3 times the level given by the same salespeople when selling existing products. The evidence suggests that the seller's attention is much more on the product than on their customers. To be frank, I've done it myself. You've probably done the same thing too. Whenever Huthwaite launches a new product, we get all excited and enthusiastic, and we can't wait to tell our clients all about it. And like so many other companies, we wonder why, despite our enthusiasm, we're not making sales. We now understand that it's precisely because of our enthusiasm that we have a problem. Our enthusiasm has led us to become product-centered and to give features and advantages. As we've seen in this chapter, that's not an effective strategy for the major sale. The problem-solving approach. We had an interesting opportunity to test whether something as simple as excessive features and advantages could really account for the slow growth of new product sales. A major company in a medical market invited us to carry out an experiment with the launch of one of its new products. The product was a sophisticated and expensive piece of diagnostic equipment. It was clearly in the category of the larger sale. The machine was launched in most of the sales force in the conventional way. A high key presentation of its features and advantages by the product marketing team. But we were allowed to launch it differently with a small experimental group of salespeople. Instead of showing them the product and describing its features and advantages, we didn't even let them see what they would be selling. It's not important, we explained. What is important is that this machine is designed to solve problems for the doctors who use it. We then listed the problems the machine solved and the needs it met. Finally, we had our group make a list of accounts where these problems could exist, together with the problem, implication, and need payoff questions they would ask when they visited those accounts. By launching the product in terms of the problems it solved and how to probe for them, we were able to shift our small group's attention away from the product and back to customer needs. The proof that this was an effective strategy is in the sales results. Our group averaged a 54% higher level of sales than the rest of the sales force during the product's first year. This research on new products also gave me an explanation for something that had puzzled me for many years. Some of the people with the best records for selling new products are the most cynical about product launches. I remember going to a product launch at Acapulco some years ago. The event was splendiferous. Big names from the entertainment world had been hired at unbelievable cost, and the place swarmed with public relations people, media specialists, communication consultants, and a variety of similarly expensive people. The salespeople, eagerly awaiting the great event, filled into the main hall to hear one of the most spectacular and costly feature dumps of the decade. I was depressed at the enormous expense my client had gone to in order to make the sales force communicate the new product ineffectively, so I decided to wait outside until all the fuss and spectacle subsided. As I sat by the pool, I noticed two other people who had slipped out of the same presentation. Talking with them, I found that they were both very experienced high performers. "It's just another product," said one. "When the fuss dies down, I'll go back in and figure out which customers need it." Clearly, he wasn't going to fall into the trap of neglecting needs in favor of features and advantages. Have you ever noticed how, just when the product is proving to be a disappointment and the sales force is losing its enthusiasm, sales suddenly start to improve? I recall exactly that happening when I was involved in the launch of a large new copying machine. At the time, I thought it was curious that sales were terrible until the sales force stopped being excited by the new product. Then, at the point where everybody was beginning to say, "This new machine isn't anything special," results took a dramatic turn for the better. I couldn't explain it, because it seemed so much the opposite of common sense. You'd think that the machines would be most successful when it was new, with maximum sales force enthusiasm and maximum competitive lead time. Now I know what was happening. As they became disillusioned, the attention of the salespeople turned away from the product and back to the customer. There's a lesson here for anybody concerned with successful product launches. Several of our large multinational clients, on the basis of Huthwaite's research, now handle launches in a new way. Instead of giving features and advantages when they announce new products to the sales force, they concentrate on explaining the problems the product solves and on thinking up the questions that will uncover and develop these problems. It's proved a very successful method for speeding the growth curve of new product sales. Demonstrating capability effectively. What are the central messages in this chapter that will help you demonstrate your capability more effectively in larger sales? I would pick out three main practical points. One, don't demonstrate capabilities too early in the call. In smaller sales, you can uncover a problem and jump straight in with advantages about how you can solve it. But this doesn't work well in larger sales. It's important in larger sales to develop explicit needs by using implication and need payoff questions before you offer solutions. Presenting capabilities too soon is one of the most common mistakes in large accounts. It's made worse because many customers will encourage you to present solutions in the absence of any information about needs. "Just come and make a presentation about your product," they tell you, "and we'll decide whether it fits our needs." If you're forced to make presentations of features and advantages early in the selling cycle, always try to have a minimum of one pre-meeting with a key person in the account to uncover needs so that your presentation includes at least some benefits. 2. Beware advantages. Most sales training, because it's based on models appropriate to smaller sales, encourages you to give advantage statements when you sell. And to complicate the issue, the term they use for such statements is benefits. Don't let previous training mislead you. Remember that in larger sales, the powerful statements are those which show that you can meet explicit needs.